You can't dance at two parties at the same time. I was just teaching, and I'd hope to divide this sermon into two parts, one before the shofar blowing and one after, but we're going to roll with it. So I want to talk about sincerity and authenticity and offer it as a new reading of the Akedah, of the binding of Isaac. So let me begin with the story of Jeanine Shepherd. Jeanine was a premier skier en route to represent Australia in the Winter Olympics. And in one TED talk, she spoke of how throughout her life, she had always identified herself as her body. Indeed, one of the names her friends had given her was Jeanine the Machine, because she could push herself harder and faster than anyone else. She was a world-class athlete, fully in charge of herself. All of that changed, however, one day when she was on a training bike ride in a mountain that she skied in, and a truck came around a curve and hit her. Jeanine suffered a massive spinal cord injury that left her severely injured and mostly paralyzed. She endured a couple of harrowing weeks in the hospital that she called her death experience. Miss Shepherd related that at some level of soul, she understood in those dark moments that she had the choice of whether or not to return to her body. She was aware that her body, once under her machine-like control, was broken beyond repair. And still, she decided to return. She chose life. At the age of 24, she had to discover that a broken body isn't a broken person. Listening to Jeanine's story confronts us with the notion that we are rarely who we think we are, that life will force us, sometimes dramatically, as was her case, and sometimes in quieter ways, to change our self-perception. In Jeanine's case, external change was forced upon her on that mountain road. A year after the accident, when a plane flew directly overhead, her life's direction changed again. Looking up, she decided, if I can't walk, and I can't run, and I can't ski, then I'll fly. It was her shofar moment. And that's exactly what she proceeded to do. She gained her commercial pilot's license, went on to earn an instructor's license so she could teach others to fly, and then became a aerobatics pilot, tricks, and taught others that as well. In the years since, she's written several books and become a sought-after motivational speaker. Did Jeanine Shepherd change because of her accident? Well, clearly, she could no longer identify herself as an athlete. A core part of what she considered her authentic self evaporated when the truck hit her. She was forced to concede that she was no longer a skier. Simultaneously, that indomitable will and spirit that drove her to Olympic-level achievement, that also propelled her toward other remarkable attainments and accomplishments. Her iron will was the same before and after. It's not so easy to decide if she was the same person pre and post accident, though she believes she has become a better person on account of the accident. The world's great stories never mean one thing, because they're about people, and people can never be explained completely. Stories operate at the deepest level of the soul, and so they're never exhausted. As Brian Rohr, a storyteller and one of our front office people, put it, stories have a heart, and the role of the storyteller is to connect their heart and the heart of the listener with the heart of the story. We return to these perennial stories year after year, and we're able to mine new understandings from their endless wisdom and their beating heart, in part because we've gained new wisdom and new perspectives in the intervening time. Our heart is therefore open to hearing something different in a familiar narrative. Among the treasury of enduring tales, the Akedah, or the Binding of Isaac, continues to fascinate. It'd be hard to think of another story that has been as open to as many different understandings. Is Abraham the knight of faith, the ideal Jew, an abusive father? Did he pass a test or fail it? Is the Akedah the preeminent story by which humans ended child sacrifice as a way to serve and draw near to God? Or does it highlight that every parent sacrifices their child on an altar of their own making, on the altar of high achievement, perhaps, as we Jews are often accused of doing? We can produce strong readings to defend any and all of these possibilities. What I'd like to suggest is, like Janine Shepherd, we put aside our past understandings of the Akedah so we can give a fair hearing to a new understanding, one that I hope will be both timely and relevant to each of us. Namely, I want to propose that the Akedah is the perfect collision of the conflicting values of authenticity and sincerity. It pitches authenticity versus sincerity. Moreover, if we reflect on authenticity and sincerity, we will be able to glean some insights into key challenges of our time and of the role of teshuvah. I also believe that by analyzing some different concepts of authenticity and sincerity, we'll gain a better grasp of selfishness, duty, and the sovereign self. It is the various ways that these three things interact, selfishness, duty, and the sovereign self, that we can come to understand a source for many of today's challenges. If we can forge a healthier relationship between our duties to others and the needs of the sovereign self, I believe teshuva will be easier, we'll be able to live with greater equanimity, and that the world will benefit. This is a sermon, in other words, where I will argue and plead with you that we all need to live with both greater authenticity and sincerity. For the sake of the sermon, I'd like to offer two simple definitions of authenticity and sincerity. They're not how we use these words in everyday usage, and yet they capture the historical meanings which I will share with you. So first, a quick understanding, and then we'll dive in a little bit to the history of these terms. So authenticity refers to the real McCoy, whether it is a work of art or a person. And authenticity, when we're talking about people, says that my emotions and my internal reality are more important than rationality or even a social role. Under authenticity, my primary responsibility is to me, myself, and I. Authenticity is a relationship, in other words, that we have with ourselves, and it is static because it assumes that each of us possess a core, unchanging essence. Sincerity is something different. Sincerity is our social persona. It's a commitment we make to the society around us that we'll do what we say and that we'll present ourselves as we are. And because it is relational, it is therefore dynamic. Authenticity, my relationship with myself, is the primary source of authority, static. Sincerity, my relationship with and duty to others, is the primary source of authority, dynamic. So now to a little bit of that history. I hope you're with me. So it's beyond the scope of a Rosh Hashanah sermon to run through this history in depth, but it's important to get a little bit of a grasp of these ideas because they filter into today's society. They continue to impact us. And if we don't know where authenticity comes from, then when we claim we're being an authentic person, we're actually not. We're just living another person's script from another idea in the past. So the history. In 1971, cultural critic Lionel Trilling penned a highly influential book called Authenticity and Sincerity. And in it, he tracked how those two ways of being have come to define a lot of Western civilization. Most of us are probably familiar with Shakespeare's famous line, "To thine own self, be true. 200 years later, this idea was popularized by figures like the Enlightenment thinker Jean-Jacques Rousseau and was given the name of authenticity. There had to have been something in the air at that time, because simultaneously in the Jewish world, Rabbi Simcha Bunim is espousing the same thing, and he had never read a word of Rousseau. And in fact, so much of our Jewish world is influenced by Bunim's notions of authenticity, and most of us aren't even aware of the impact he's had. One secular philosopher in particular made authenticity the center concept of his philosophy, and that was Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And he believed that authenticity would lead us to a higher form of human consciousness. But he also wrote that it had a cost because people feel alienated from themselves and others. And he was willing to deal with the cost because he thought the benefit of that higher consciousness would be worth it. For Hegel, sincerity was only the heroism of dumb service. And what he meant was that without authenticity, people plod through their lives somewhat mindlessly. Put differently, sincerity is how we internalize conventional social norms and behaviors. Sincerity is how we all become bourgeoisie. And to bring that down from the sky a little bit, if you go to school to earn good grades so you can go to a good school, so you can get a good career and do your part, then you're acting out of sincerity. You're filling a role. And indeed, what we learn from these Enlightenment thinkers is that authenticity was a mixed blessing. It gave us autonomy, a good thing, but it also gave us alienation, a bad thing. Yet they go hand in hand. If you believe in the rights of the individual, you're for authenticity. Authenticity gave us women's rights, gay rights, gender rights, protections against racism, the rights of religious minorities, one person, one vote. Authenticity gave us the rise of the novel, which celebrates the inner life of the individual. It has created a flowering of artists and an appreciation of different cultures. It has given everyone a voice. Authenticity honors the charismatic person. But authenticity also gives us self-obsession and narcissism. It underlies societal polarization and fractious identity politics. Authenticity has also given us the resurgence of public racism, because what I feel about others is simply a true expression of my inner realm. There's no need to control my thoughts or behavior about the other. Authenticity accounts for our distrust in public institutions, and in all institutions for that matter, because institutions are primarily about our responsibilities one to another, and they demand that we limit ourselves to exist within them. James Nolan, in his book, The Therapeutic State, argues that authenticity has harmed our democracy. Our focus on the self has had unintended consequences. Emotional arguments have replaced reasoned discourse in congressional hearings, in our criminal justice system, and in both public and private education. We often have placed a student's self-esteem as higher or higher than their basic literacy in a subject. 20 years ago, Nolan prophetically said that the cult of authenticity partly accounts for our poor choice of political leaders. The individual is sovereign with all that is good and bad about that. Sincerity is the very opposite of that, and in many ways it has been on the decline for a long time. For centuries before the rise of authenticity, the norm of sincerity offered a different notion of selfhood, of what it meant to be a person. And once again, Shakespeare said it best. All the world's the stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts. Shakespeare's self in that soliloquy is both public and social. Rather than there being an essential true core to each person, we take on different roles based on our interactions with others. Right now, I'm a rabbi. Later today, I'll be a father, a host, a neighbor. I change based on my roles and duties. I don't give sermons to my neighbors, and I don't exhort them to behave in a certain manner. That would just be weird. In other words, sincerity rests in reconciling our performance of tolerance with the people we become. There are a lot of benefits to this older model of behavior because it built trust in institutions, in politics. It insisted on mutual responsibility. Its central currency was character rather than charisma. Will someone keep their promises? Will they honor the meanings and understandings we tacitly negotiate? Are their polite gestures consciously offered in good faith? Sincerity is also stifling. It's the twin of conformity. It boxes us into particular roles, even if those don't quite match what we feel on the inside. Sincerity led gay people to try to pass as heterosexuals. It left people in unfulfilling jobs. It had a conservative effect on social institutions and individual lives, preventing necessary change and reducing tolerance for risk-taking. As we heard Hegel say earlier, sincerity is the heroism of dumb service. So here's the question. How are we to square these two ways of being? What are our duties to self and our responsibilities to the larger world? What's the nature of this teshuva that we're called upon to do now and on Yom Kippur? Is teshuva returning to who we essentially are? A restoration of our basic identity? Can there really be such a thing? And isn't our authenticity still tied to society and understandings greater than just our own internal relationship? Don't we still play roles even when we're being authentic? Or is teshuva that process by which we strive to become something we are not yet, a better version of ourselves? Is teshuva, in other words, an act of authenticity or a commitment to sincerity? And where can we find the answer? Within the Bible. Within the Bible, we have one pure example of the conflict between sincerity and authenticity in which the public is absent. The variables are removed, and we're able to look at it in the purest way possible, and that is the story of Akedat Yitzhak, of the binding of Isaac. Because on the one hand, Abraham has been called the first authentic individual. The birth of the individual is actually ascribed to him. God told him, Lech Lecha, go to yourself. And Abraham threw off societal constraints. He threw off midrashic constraints when he smashed a shop full of idols. Remember that story? He threw off biblical constraints when he left his birth country, when he allowed his nephew Lot to choose which parcel of land to take, when he founded a new religion, when he devoted to an invisible and non-local God, when he started a new social movement, which we hear about when we learn that all the souls that he and Sarah acquired, none of those actions were socially acceptable in Abraham's day. None of them. And on the other hand, Abraham is the perfect example of Hegel's hero of dumb service. When God tells him he'll start a new nation, Abraham sincerely obeys. When his nephew Lot is captured by some tribal kings, he sincerely gathers an army to rescue him, fulfilling his duty without taking even a shoelace in payment, the Torah tells us. And in yesterday's Torah reading, when Sarah tells him to send forth Hagar because she is undermining their traditional family structure, their institution, he concedes and sends his other wife out into the wilderness. And at Mount Moriah, at the binding of Isaac itself that we read in this room just a few moments ago, Abraham the sincere is confronted with authentic Abraham. If he kills his son as God commanded, he will be a sincere person, fulfilling his social role and responsibility as God's servant and founder of a nation and a religion that is meant to change the world. But as an individual, as an authentic person with a normal love of family, how can he kill his son, his only son, the one he loves, Yitzhak? How can he kill a part of himself? And how on earth can society as represented by God demand such an impossible sacrifice from him? In this reading of the Akedah, Abraham remains frozen in time with the knife mid-air for what seems like an eternity. Who is he to be in that moment? What is expected of him? God told him to kill Isaac. God also told him that the Jewish people would be descended from Isaac. Abraham has been put in the perfect double bind. As contemporary biblical scholar Reuven Kimmelman marks, no matter what he does, he will disobey God, and no matter what he does, therefore, he will also obey God. And more importantly, who are we called to be during these Yamim Noraim, these days of awe? Speaking personally, it's clear to me that our age is out of alignment. We privilege our authenticity over our sincerity. The rights of the individual override any sense of responsibility to larger society. Our parochial identity politics override our patriotism and commitment to the larger value of America. And apart from the people in this room, in this sanctuary, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, Gavalt, our personal spirituality takes precedence over our covenant with God and the Jewish people. We need more sincerity and less narcissism, more duty and less self-expression, more community and less alienation. Yet above even that, there's a value for each of us to feel ourselves frozen between those two poles of being. We should feel the knife in our hand. We should know as adults, as moral agents, that we can't get it right, not completely. We should know that our lives are constantly in motion. We should understand that in any given moment we are all being tested and that sometimes we must let the knife fall while other times we must use it. We have to understand that above all else, God demands that we must change and that none of us are permitted to remain standing where we are. When the truck clipped her bike and when she looked up at that airplane, Jane Shepherd heard that message. When Abraham stared at his bound son and his heart breaking from the near impossibility, he heard the message. This is what it means to be a limited mortal being. And this is what today, Yom HaDin, the Day of Judgment, is. At every heightened moment of moral dilemma, we must ask, where are our duties? To self or society? And if we get it right, we get to live deeply and humanly, and we get to live in a healthy society that doesn't tear itself apart. This is our choice, and this is our legacy. Choose well, friends. Choose well.